This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, talking about labor and issues facing North Carolina's workforce, which leads us to Robeson County, where organizers of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union are trying to unionize the Mount Air Farms chicken processing plant. You might remember UFCW from a battle in the mid-2000s at Smithfield Foods. The UFCW led a fight that allowed workers at a huge pork processing plant in Tar Heel to vote for union representation. Keith Ludlam was on the front lines of that fight. He's with me now. He's president of the UFCW Local 1208. Keith Ludlam, welcome to the State of Things.
Oh, thanks, Frank, and good afternoon to you.
It's good to talk with you. We're going to talk about Mount Air here in a minute, so I want to tell everybody that a representative of Mount Air Farms said the firm would not be able to provide a spokesman to be on today's program, but we'll try to talk to them later. Meanwhile, Keith, tell us what's happening at Mount Air.
Well, Mount Air is a 2,000-employee poultry processing plant located in Lumber Bridge, North Carolina, which is in southeast North Carolina in Robeson County. And those workers over there have called us, and they're just appalled at the wages and the treatment they're getting over there. And so we're assisting those workers with gaining union representation like we did at Smithfield.
All right. Well, tell us about Smithfield, because that was a long fight. You were at the center of it, and the fight for you began, I think, back in 1994, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, like many people in North Carolina or in the South, I didn't know a lot about unions until I started working at this large slaughterhouse. And soon I saw the conditions and the pay and the way people are treated. And again, you know, when you have these large employers with thousands of employees, a lot of times there's a disconnect between those that are running it and those that are actually out there working on the floor. And so they forget that there's a human being with a family in your community that's out there. And, you know, a lot of times that's why we need a union in the workplaces, so we can remind the employer that these are our neighbors in our communities, and they need to be treated decently and paid decently.
Well, and again, we're back at Smithfield now, and this is the earlier fight, a pork processing plant where you started back in the 90s. What did you see on that floor?
Well, I mean, I saw, you know, workers getting injured. I saw workers getting fired that I didn't feel like should have been fired, and began educating myself on, you know, how we could protect ourselves, and found that the only real option that we have is to form a union. An entity that, you know, the workers are a member of and legally represents the employees and gives them some power, you know. And unions aren't a foreign concept. You know, the United States is a union itself. Corporations are a union of shareholders. And so a labor union is simply the workers themselves coming together and standing together in order to gain better wages and working conditions.
Well, Smithfield didn't see it that way. Tell us what happened when you started your effort.
Well, shortly after I started, you know, talking to my coworkers and getting them to sign union cards, the company targeted me, harassed me, then terminated my employment. It took me 12 years of fighting them in court, but I was reinstated in 2006 by the federal courts.
Well, tell us about that, because North Carolina, the South in general, and North Carolina in particular, has never been particularly friendly to unions, and people who have tried to start unions here have failed. What was going on in those 12 or 14 years or so, and how was it that you prevailed?
Well, basically, the UFCW had filed charges with the National Labor Relations Board that I was fired because of my union activity and no other reason, no legitimate legal reason. And so I went to trial, and we showed evidence where that was the case, and they found in my favor. But, of course, in this country, everybody has the right to appeal. So you have these multi-million-dollar corporations, they're able to appeal for years. And so they appealed my case for, you know, 12 years until they ran out of appeals and finally had to be reinstated.
I think that's an important point, because the right to organize capital certainly gives an advantage if you're going to fight a long fight in the courts against maybe an undercapitalized union that's organizing people. So you have to be able to wait that out, that long 12-year stretch.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people just don't realize that a lot of our laws, our labor laws, are so antiquated. They're not really able to stand up to these billion-dollar corporations nowadays. They have a tremendous advantage because they have so much money. So any penalties that they may incur for breaking the law as far as labor law really isn't a deterrent. And they'll continue to use these tactics to prevent workers from organizing.
So what happened when you were reinstated? Tell us about that and then the final effort to get union representation.
Yeah, I was reinstated, and then I was able to go back in the plant. We were able to educate our coworkers, get them past the fear. And in 2008, the workers won their victory of gaining unionization at Smithfield. And in the summer of 2009, we gained our first contract with the company. And I've had a great working relationship with the company since then. And, you know, many of them, I don't know if they'll admit it publicly, but many of them will tell you that, you know, they don't understand why they spent so much money and so much effort fighting, because the plant does run well, and we do have a good working relationship with the employer.
Well, and apparently attractive enough to be bought out by a Chinese firm, so it's not going out of business, right?
Right. And that's another important reason, that buyout, you know, that's another important reason why we had a contract here at Tar Heel, because in our contract we had language that if they were merged or were purchased by anybody, then they had to honor our labor agreement in order for that purchase to happen. And so nothing changed for the workers here at Tar Heel.
Well, and again, that, I just want to point out that that means somebody at the financial end who's about to make a big corporate deal,
yeah,
and is looking out for their shareholders for that giant Chinese conglomerate looked at that clause and said, in order for us to take this, we have to take this contract, mm-hmm, and it still has to be profitable.
Exactly.
And in the end, they decided it would be okay and signed.
So
tell us about the demographics here, because that was one of the interesting factors at the Tar Heel plant, the split between immigrant workers, Latino workers, and African Americans, pretty closely evenly divided, which also created problems initially for organizing, didn't it?
Yes, I mean, you know, in many of these slaughterhouses and many workplaces, even in the state now and on our farms in North Carolina, you do have a language barrier that you have to get across with a lot of the immigrant workers that have moved into our area. But that was the important thing with the campaign, is that we had everybody included. And UFCW was able to provide that, and we continue to provide that during representation. We have bilingual representatives. So you do have to cross that language barrier. But once you cross that language barrier, people are just human. And their interest is workers, you know, and looking out for their interests as workers.
Was it? I remember reading that it was more than just a language barrier, but you were there, so you tell me if this is wrong, that there were actual racial and ethnic tensions between the groups that went beyond language. I don't know if that's true, but that's what I read.
Well, again, I believe that those tensions came from not being able to communicate. And once you can communicate with people, that's the biggest barrier, you know. I mean, we find that even when we're dealing with other countries as the U.S., right, that being able to communicate and have diplomatic relationships a lot of times takes care of a lot of tensions and problems.
Well, let's go back now to Mount Air in Robeson County. This is a poultry processing plant. It produces an awful lot of chicken. And what do we know? What about the conditions there? And again, why in particular, what are the things that workers are telling you that they'd like to see change?
Well, you know, like I said, this is 2,000 employees that are about 25 minutes from our plant, and that's happening a lot in North Carolina. We have these large plants being put up in rural areas of North Carolina that require thousands of people in order for them to run, and so those workers found out what the union difference was, because we have many former Smithfield workers that work at Mount Air, and we have many Mount Air workers that now work at Smithfield. And so they see that union difference, and so they started calling us and telling us, hey, we want to have the same things at Mount Air, because top pay at Mount Air is $10 an hour. We've got people that have been out there 12 years, and all they're making is $10 an hour. And full-time, hard-working jobs like they are, they just can't provide for their families with that kind of a pay scale.
Where do things stand now? Where are you in the process?
Well, right now we're talking to workers, and we're getting workers to sign union cards. And the union cards are basically for us to show the labor board that there's enough interest from the workers in the workplace to have a vote. And so, of course, the company is using some of the same old tactics that many companies use. They're threatening workers with arrest. They're threatening workers with being fired. They're telling workers they can't get union cards signed in the workplace. And all these things are illegal, and so we have about 17 charges that the labor board has investigated and found enough evidence and issued a complaint against Mount Air, and they'll answer for that in court in October.
All right, Keith, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, yes, and thank you so much for bringing attention and education in North Carolina that unions are legal and they are necessary for workers to have a better life.
Thanks, Keith. Keith Ludlam is president of UFCW Local 1208. And as I said, we contacted Montair Farms, and a spokesman said that they were not able to provide a spokesman for today's program. So we're continuing our conversation about organized labor today on the state of things. And joining us now is Jeff Hirsch. He teaches labor law at UNC Chapel Hill, in addition to being the associate dean for academic affairs. Jeff, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Steve Allen. He studied labor law for nearly 40 years at NC State, where he is currently Associate Dean for Graduate Programs and Research. Hello, Steve Allen. Welcome back.
Glad to be here.
Let's talk about North Carolina. We've mentioned it a couple times just in passing, North Carolina not a particularly labor-friendly state. I mean, what does that mean? Is there any legal barrier, or is it just a place where people don't like unions?
I think it's probably more of the latter. I mean, there are some legal barriers, for instance, the right to work laws, which we can talk about later in the program, although that's something that North Carolina shares with, you know, 20 or so other states. But a lot of the economics in the state, which I'll defer, I think point to that problem as well.
What about that, Steve? I mean, what about unions? Is that, you know, workers certainly have complaints. Is there a place for them? What do you think?
Well, you know, you can try complaining, and you just talked to the gentleman who was at Smith, you know, worked for Smithfield, and did him a lot of good. There's certainly, I think, you know, workers, for better or worse, don't have as many choices as capitalists. If you're a capitalist and you don't like the rate of return on your investment, you can yank it out of one company or one mutual fund and put it in another. It's in fact, Jeff could be trading right here on his iPad.
I hope not.
If you know, he just felt the urge.
Right.
You know, workers have made significant investments in the company, in the community, and it is a lot more difficult to transfer their skills to another place at the drop of a hat. So there is a certain asymmetry there, and you know, historically, unions have played a role in giving unions some economic leverage in bargaining, and also to be the voice of workers and a protected voice of the workers in terms of managing the workplace.
And in terms of balance and equilibrium with workers and the workplace, I mean, it is true that capital is organized, right? I mean, that's what Wall Street does. It organizes capital, and it certainly makes choices. If your margins aren't good in that company, we will withdraw our capital. We're leaving your company. We're going somewhere else, and that CEO just got a message, and he was going to look at every one of those lines in his budget, and if labor's too high, he's going to change it.
Yeah. I wouldn't overestimate how organized they are. If they were all that well organized, we wouldn't have gone through 2008 and Lehman Brothers and the economy tanking. I think there is, though, constant competitive pressure. It's greater today than when I entered the economics profession 40 years ago. We have a global economy. We have a lot more pressure from technological change, and so that's changed the ballgame.
Well, I want to challenge you in that, because it does organize around financial principles and algorithms that are set up, and that's why. It's precisely that organization that brought us 2008. It made a lot of sense to atomize these credit default and make credit default swaps and atomize bad home loans so that the risk was spread out. That made perfect sense. That was an organized effort, albeit across a wide number of instruments and a wide number of stocks. But the organization was around the principle. It turned out it was flawed, and it busted the system.
Yeah, and I think what I was talking about is this an all-knowing, all-seeing system?
No.
And it's clearly not. If you've read Michael Lewis's book about the crash, it's clear nobody had a clue as to what these instruments of mass financial destruction really could do.
Right. But it does organize, and it organizes around principles. So Jeff, let's talk about that. I mean, what is the equilibrium? What's the leverage that workers have?
Well, and before I get to that, let me add one thing on the organizational issue. One thing, area where employers are in fact quite organized, is once they've decided to fight unionization, there are a whole host of law and other types of firms that specialize in union busting, and they're quite good at it. And so that's an area where you actually see quite a bit of organization. And as far as options for workers, right, it's very difficult. This, as Steve is noting, when you lack the economic leverage, that takes away much, if not most, of workers' ability to exert any leverage over their employers. That said, there certainly are things that they can do, although as Mr. Ludlum illustrated, it's quite difficult and a long process, but the laws, in fact, do work here in North Carolina and apply here for the most part, and so there's plenty of collective action that workers can take. You also see, even outside of the formal unionization process, there's been a worldwide move against fast food restaurants, for instance, that have gotten a lot of attention, Black Friday protests against Walmart. Right. How successful those end up being is an open question, but certainly workers have an ability, particularly I think where they're dealing with employers that have a retail customer base that might be open to that kind of message. Mm-hmm. Right, that's a place where there is some additional leverage.
But at that point, they have to affect the bottom line, which then the CEO becomes sensitive to, because the law doesn't necessarily favor them. How have laws changed, or have they changed, in terms of protecting workers?
Yeah, I mean, in when you think about traditional union, say, labor law, not very much, right? Mr. Ludlum noted that, it's been quite static over the years, and there's been few formal statutory changes, although the NLRB itself can make adjustments. Beyond that, in other type of areas, discrimination laws, for instance, there's been quite a bit of movement over the years. And then we've seen
movement
even
in what direction?
Well, there's been, a fairly broad expansion. I mean, obviously, we're hitting a big anniversary for the 1964 Civil Rights Act, mm-hmm. which was a dramatic change from the previous laws. And even as recently as, 1991 was the Disability Act was first enacted. And there's now push to add sexual orientation. So we do see movement. Statutory change is slow, but, there's a lot of dispute over it, but executive orders are possible as well. President Obama a month or so ago had a new executive order requiring any federal contractors to report any labor and employment violations of the last 3 years. Right, that's a fairly sizable group of employers that can have an impact, I think.
Steve Allen, what do you make of the fact that I remember right after union certification was announced, Smithfield said, and by the way, we're closing the plant. And they didn't. Not only that, they've been bought out by people who presumably are savvy enough to see that they are now saddled with a union contract. How burdensome is a union, really?
Well, I'm going to give you the classic academic answer, and it depends. To make it, I think, clear, it really depends on how much value gets created by the whole enterprise, management and labor together, as a result of the union joining. And are there, there's a potential, and if they work together, to actually make the pie bigger, in which case management can still get its rate of return and union workers can get a big pay raise. And that hopefully is what's happened. It sounds like they probably have new management at Smithfield, and that's right. Certainly different attitude, if not different guys and gals running the place. On the other hand, there's cases like where the pie gets smaller or there's no way of changing the pie. I mean, you look at professional sports, for instance, you got four downs to make 10 yards. You can't really change that. And so you're fighting constantly over a pie that's never going to get any bigger or smaller because of the union being there. So those situations get very contentious.
Does it make more sense for companies to put – you talked about the union busting efforts. Those are expensive legal efforts and sometimes extra legal efforts that cost money. Does it make more sense to put money into finding the way to work together and expand the pie?
Yeah, there certainly could be. I mean, you oftentimes hear the phrase that companies get the union they deserve, which might include no union at all, if they treat their employees, better. One thing when I practice in the area that always struck me is sometimes the bottom line financially isn't always what's going on, that there's a lot of personalities at stake. And you got that again from Mr. Ludlum earlier, that there's oftentimes a divorce from the shareholders or owners versus the managers who are on the ground level, right? A union's a huge threat to their autonomy, and there's a lot of visceral response, negative response to that, that may not be in conjunction with actually what's good for the company's financial bottom line.
Wish we had more time, but I want to thank both of you. Jeff Hirsch teaches labor law at UNC Chapel Hill. Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks.
Steve Allen, currently Associate Dean for Graduate Programs and Research at NC State. Thanks, Steve.
All right.
Coming up, we're going to hear about Labor Sabbath, a movement to change the stigma around the words labor union. We'll hear about that on the State of Things. Stay tuned.